In the early morning hours of February 24th, Russia launched a massive invasion of Ukraine. Despite dire predictions, Ukraine did not fall rapidly, and as of recording, they're putting up a stout defense across the country. The air war over Ukraine is the most contested since at least Allied force over Yugoslavia and Kosovo in 1999, and most likely since Desert Storm in 1991. Though we're still early in the conflict, there's much to examine, discuss, evaluate, and there are lessons to be learned from the initial phase of this conflict. In this special episode of the Air Minded podcast, I'll cover the first 3 days of the air war over Ukraine. This is the Air Minded podcast. Welcome back, listeners. I'm the Air Minded Gorilla Tyson Wetzel, back from an extended break for the holidays. And then as tensions began between Russia and Ukraine, I became really almost solely focused on the military buildup and the potential for war. But I'm back for this special episode to look at the air war over Ukraine. Though I'm still an active duty Air Force officer, I have the great opportunity to work for a think tank in Washington, D.C. It's called the Atlantic Council. As the name would imply, one of the primary focus areas of the Atlantic Council is transatlantic issues, including NATO, Russia, and very topically for this crisis and this episode, Ukraine. Since the first week of January, I've been monitoring, analyzing, and writing about the Russian military buildup and the potential for a large-scale war with Ukraine. Since the war kicked off late on the evening of February 23rd, I've been scouring social media for legitimate sources of information, for confirmed photos and videos. I've been trying to figure out the progress of this war. Not surprisingly, I've been really focused in particular on the air war. And though we may only be about 3 days or 72 hours into the conflict as of the time that I'm recording this, there's already plenty of what I would consider significant topics to cover and lessons to be learned from the air war. I've broken this episode into four pieces. First, I'm going to talk about the Russian military buildup of air and air defense forces and why the specific forces that they deployed are important. Second, I'm going to talk about a kind of a recap of the war so far with a specific focus on the fight for air superiority over Ukraine. Third, over the last couple of days, I asked for your questions on Twitter and I'll get the chance to answer some of those. And then fourth, and probably what you're all here to listen for anyways, I'm going to examine the myth of the ghost of Kyiv and try to separate fact from fiction. So before I get into that, there's something that I wanted to say and there's no real easy transition to it. I'm going to be taking a dispassionate look at this air war in this episode, but that does not mean that I am dispassionate about this war and its effects. Regardless of the validity of the casualty counts that are being bandied about on social media, this much is clear. Hundreds and likely thousands of people have already died and will continue to perish in this war. Unfortunately, many of them are innocent civilians killed either on purpose or as collateral damage. This is a humanitarian crisis of epic proportions. Likely millions of Ukrainians will be displaced, left with virtually nothing, and mentally or physically scarred by this war. Commentators on social media are quick to place the blame on this administration, or the last one, on specific European nations or NATO. I have no time for playing that blame game. In my opinion, there's only one person to blame for this nightmare, and that's Vladimir Putin, period. He ordered this war. I'm not a warmonger. I want this war to be over as quickly and as painlessly as possible. I never ask anything of you, the listeners, in terms of support, and I don't intend to start now. If, however, you want to help in some small way, I'd encourage you to do your own research online and find an organization that you feel comfortable with that is doing good work to help out. I personally am supporting the International Rescue Committee, which can be found at help.rescue.org. Like I said at the beginning of that comment, there's no real good transition to that subject and away from that subject. But with all of that said, let's get into talking about the air war over Ukraine. All right, let's get into it. Part one is the military buildup of Russian forces, in particular air and air defense forces. Before I get into this, I just want to put in one more caveat. I am an intelligence officer by trade, but I do want to point out that I've not looked at a piece of classified intelligence since I took this new job. That way there's no way I can inadvertently disclose classified information because I simply haven't looked at it. So everything that I'm going to be telling you about is not classified information. It's all from open source that's available to everyone. That means that it's probably not going to be 100% accurate. I can only report on what I've seen. And that's going to be a little bit significant for the buildup of military forces, but it's going to be really significant when we get into part two and we're talking about combat employment and the results. I really am reliant on what I'm able to read from the open source press. But getting into the military buildup. So first off, what you need to know about Russia is that there's five military districts, and the two military districts that have forces in the general area of the southwest of their country along the border with Ukraine is the Western Military District and the Southern Military District. And both of those already have a ton of forces associated with them, especially air and air defense forces. The Western Military Region covers Moscow and St. Petersburg, so there's a ton of systems there. But down in the southwestern part of the country, there's not as many permanently assigned forces because there's not major cities to protect, if you will. So when we're talking about what's already there in place prior to the military buildup that began in November of 2021, but really started getting reported on a lot in the Western media starting in about January of 2022. So anyways, that is all going to be additory to what we already see. So let's talk about the air and air defense forces that are there prior to the buildup. So there's lots of, and I'm just going to generally break them into air superiority versus ground attack aircraft, and then we'll talk some helicopters as well, and the surface-to-air missile systems. And I realize there's a lot more that goes into employing military force in an air campaign, but just to try and keep it a little bit top level. So Russia has they've done a pretty good job of using their somewhat limited resources, financially at least, to improve their military. They have been building, recapitalizing their force, and they have been procuring and continuing to develop high technology advanced equipment. In particular, in the Air Force, they have really recapitalized their force. They've gone from a very heavy MiG-29 Fulcrum and Su-27 flanker force that was built in the late 70s, early 80s. That line kind of died off in 91 when the Soviet Union fell. But especially as Putin, the economy started to improve in the early aughts, they're putting a lot of money into development of new aircraft and really using those same airframes. So there's upgraded MiG-29s, but for the most part, those are sort of kind of out of operational service. There's still a few, but really the flanker, which is the basic Su-27, has continued to be upgraded. There's air-to-air variants, a new Su-27, it's known as the SM. There's a multi-role, so the Su-27 SM kind of upgraded variant. I would make that analogous to the F-15C in U.S. Air Force service. They've got a very strong, multiple strong multi-role platforms, including the Su-30 SM, which is an advanced variant of the Su-30. I would say most analogous to the F-15E Strike Eagle in U.S. Air Force parlance or service, if you will. They have a really advanced ground attack platform known as the Su-34 Fullback. Some people call it the Fighting Platypus. It's got a platypus-looking nose. That thing has a huge combat stores in terms of what it can carry. It's still got some air-to-air, actually very strong air-to-air capabilities, so it's tough to give it an exact equivalent in the U.S. Air Force or U.S. military service. I would say I'll again make it analogous to the F-15E Strike Eagle if that Strike Eagle really didn't train much to air-to-air at all. And then just in a straight air-to-ground platform, things like the Su-24 Fencer and the Su-25 Frogfoot. And these are really focused on air-to-ground employment most analogous to the A-10 Warthog. There are dozens of these, and multiple squadrons, but dozens of these aircraft that are within their combat radius of reaching Ukraine, and in particular the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, from their home bases. So Russia didn't have to deploy a ton of forces, but they did deploy some of them. Now let's talk about air defenses in the region. And the other thing I should mention, when Russia annexed Crimea in 2014, they moved a lot of really high technology equipment to the Crimean Peninsula. But in terms of air defense, the bulk of Russian air defense is long-range advanced systems. So things like the S-400 or the NATO designator of that would be the SA-21. There's multiple variants of the S-300. NATO designator, depending on the type, is the SA-10, 20, or 23. So what do these systems do? All of them have at least 100 kilometer, some as long as 400 kilometer range. That would be the S-400. That said, based on the best information that that I can find online, it appears as though the 400 kilometer range missile on the SA-21 is not operational and will not be used in this conflict. But with all of that taken together, what I wanted to point out is that Russia has built basically what's known as the A2AD bubble, if you will, or the anti-access area denial capability. And as the name implies, anti-access area denial means that those capabilities prevent a force from getting into a specific area. It kind of denies that area. And if you can think of the A2AD as a bubble, these systems, along with the fighters, prevent friendly forces from getting in, or anti-Russian forces from getting into whatever target there is or whatever. So that's what the A2AD bubble is. In terms of what they forward deployed, so throughout November to January, they are building up their battalion tactical groups, or BTGs. At first, we were hearing as many as 100,000. Now, by the time the conflict actually kicked off, somewhere north of 170,000, and most of those would be ground troops. But they didn't deploy a ton of aircraft until right at the very end. The first deployment that I found of interest actually happened on the 20th, or at least was announced on the 26th of January. On that day, Russia and Belarus announced that they were going to be conducting a bilateral exercise that they called Union Courage 2022. In the Western media, you've probably seen it called Allied Resolve 2022. When the Russian Ministry of Defense announced that exercise, they announced a couple of deployments associated with it to Belarus. And I thought this was interesting. So they already had a lot of air and air defense assets in the Western and Southern military district. They didn't have anything in Belarus. And just as a very quick background, Belarus has been getting closer and closer to Russia's orbit, if you will. They have now agreed to become what's called a union state. Really, for all intents and purposes, Russia and Vladimir Putin have taken over Belarus. And really, Belarus does Putin's bidding. But although they have some Russian equipment, they do not have very significant air and air defense capabilities, at least not what Russia has in the Western and Southern military districts. So as part of Union Resolve, the Russian Ministry of Defense said we're going to deploy 12 Su-35Ss, and that is their most advanced flanker variant. It is their most advanced fourth generation fighter. When they put it out, they called it the fourth plus plus generation. My best analogy for this would actually be the F-15EX, the new build F-15 that we're buying with the most advanced electronic warfare sensors and large air-to-air weapon storage capability. That's kind of what the Su-35 is. It is their best of the non-fifth generation, non-stealthy platforms, which they did not deploy, and best of my knowledge, they've not used their fifth generation fighter yet. So they announced that they're going to be sending 12 Su-35s to Belarus. They also announced that they were going to be sending two divisions, which is their way of saying battalions of S-400, that SA-21. So I looked at why did they send these capabilities in particular. To me, it was pretty clear it's for two purposes. The first off is they need protection for the large number of forces that they sent to Belarus, somewhere north of 30,000 ground forces, and some people are saying 50 or 60,000. So you need protection of them. The S-400 provides pretty potent capabilities to defend points on the ground, high value targets, ground forces, etc. They did also deploy a bunch. We found out later this was not part of this announcement. They deployed a bunch of tactical SAMs that kind of move along with the ground forces. So the Su-35s and the S-400s provide a protection of the Russian forces in Belarus, but what they also did is their combat reach went into Ukraine, and actually from where they were in Belarus covered the capital of Kyiv. So What that showed to me was not only are they trying to protect their forces that are in Belarus, they are also trying to deny that airspace. They are trying to make it an A2AD or anti-access area denial area. And why would they do that? Well, first is to develop air superiority. This is going to be a major focus, we think, of the conflict when it kicks off, is to try to develop air superiority over the capital. And the second reason is to make sure there's no other foreign intervention. They don't want US, NATO, other European countries to be flying over Ukraine when the conflict starts. So you put some S-400s there that are very deadly to even high-end US and NATO aircraft. The intent is to keep those aircraft out of the combat area. It's also can prevent civil air from flying in because of the risk of being shot down like MH-17. It also will prevent resupply, things like that. So basically cutting off the air bridge into Kyiv. So I think that's why they send those particular assets. I found that very interesting. The second thing that they did, and we started to see this happen quite a bit in February, is they moved dozens and dozens of helicopters, in particular attack helicopters and then ground attack platforms, ground attack aircraft like the Su-25. I know Sukhoi or Su makes a ton of fighters and it all gets very confusing. The bottom line is they're sending tons of ground attack aircraft and ground attack helicopters to the theater. Now, the Russian Ministry of Defense also did us a little bit of a service by putting out a lot of press releases, you may say propaganda, about the Union Courage exercise. And I read each one of those, and I thought it was really interesting to show what they talked about as important. I thought this whole exercise might be a mission rehearsal, and I watched it really closely because an exercise of this sort during high tensions allows you to do two things. The first would be give plausible deniability for why you're deploying forces. Why are we deploying Su-35s? Well, we're going to be doing an exercise. This is not aggressive, would be the Russian point of view. And then the second would be to do an operational or mission rehearsal. If I'm going to be flying with Belarusian fighters, or this is me being a Russian here, if I'm going to be flying over Ukraine or Belarus, areas that I'm not familiar with, I probably want some familiarization with that airspace, with things on the ground so I know where I'm flying. I also want to check out interoperability, my ability to talk to both other Russian forces in the air and on the ground and Belarusian forces. I don't want the first time that that happens to be on night one of the conflict. So if you exercise before the war kicks off, it gives you a chance to do a mission rehearsal, or at least part task trainers, as we sometimes call it. So you go up and you exercise maybe an air-to-air fight, or you go up and you exercise close air support of a mechanized invasion, things like that. And we saw lots of that. So what are some of the things the Russian Ministry of Defense talked about? They talked about Su-35s that were on combat air patrol or CAPs that were protecting Belarus. They had one exercise in particular that I thought was really interesting that they talked about, where what they said was an aircraft would not respond to their calls and could not be identified. The Su-35s ran an intercept and shot that thing down. That, to me, was a very clear indication to non-Ukrainian countries, don't come in here. Because if you do, there's a chance you're going to be shot down. And they were actually pretty effective. We started to see insurance companies say, we're not going to insure flights into Kyiv once this war kicks off. And that started the economic strangulation, of Ukraine. But anyways, I digress, as I tend to do. So that was one of the things they talked about. So it was pretty clear to me that they were building up the ability to do air superiority and create an A2AD bubble. But what was really significant was all of the videos and press releases they did about ground attack, and in particular, close air support and interdiction. They talked a lot about working with ground forces and different types of units, including airborne units, but they talked about integrating air and ground fires, things like artillery and Su-25s or the Belarusian Yak-130s, all these ground attack platforms. And they talked a lot about working with ground attack helicopters like Mi-28s, etc. So one of the events that they talked about in particular, they showed video of a mechanized force that was moving forward, and then they said targets were identified by a UAV. They were talking the Orlan 10 UAV, and they were passed to ground attack platforms that ended up identifying and destroying those targets. Well, okay, so that's telling me that support to the ground invasion is going to be a huge mission of the Russian Air Force. Then we started to see very strange markings showing up on Russian ground force equipment, and depending on the region, maybe it was a Z or maybe it was a line across one of the sides of the vehicles. I'm convinced that those are for deconfliction of fires to try and prevent friendly fires, always a problem in conflict. But the fact that some of those were pretty small, and even the large Zs that took over the whole side of an aircraft or the whole side of an armored vehicle, actually told me a little bit about what their ground attack would look like. It would be very difficult for a fast-moving ground attack platform like a Su-34, the Fighting Platypus, to be able to pick that up. They don't particularly use targeting pods very much. They don't use night vision devices very much. So picking those symbols up, even though when we see them at handheld level, it looks pretty easy to pick up, would be extremely difficult for their air crew to pick up. So what that told me was their fighters are probably unlikely to do the bulk of the close air support or CAS. I think they'll be doing interdiction of follow-on forces of resupply, etc. So behind the front lines where they're not having to worry about friendly fire. Friendly fire is going to be especially important in this conflict because Ukraine is still working primarily with Russian-built equipment. So you have very similar-looking tanks, armored personnel carriers, infantry fighting vehicles, and aircraft. This will get to one of the questions that I'll answer later about how you do combat identification with like platforms. So anyways, I believe that they intend to use their ground attack fighters to do interdiction of second line forces. And the dozens, in fact, well over 100 attack helicopters that they moved to forward positions before night one of the conflict, were going to be doing the bulk of the close air support. So, if I'm going to be using tons and tons of helicopters, what do I need to do? I need a little bit more of a permissive environment, or those things are going to be knocked out. Now, granted, they fly really low, and it's a tough intercept, and they can use ground nap of the earth profiles to try and stay away or stay below radar coverage. But nonetheless, you can't have a really high threat environment and expect those helicopters to survive in large numbers. So that, to me, drove me to the following assessment. Here's what I thought about the first couple of days of the conflict, is that I thought that initial air and missile strikes would be heavily focused on knocking down Ukrainian air defenses to help establish air superiority. I anticipated air and missile attacks on government and military command, control, and communications, very much like the United States did on night one of Desert Storm. Try to send the Ukrainian forces autonomous, make them less lethal because they had to develop targets themselves. I also figured there would be air and missile strikes on their airfields in the intent to crater runways, prevent aircraft from taking off and trying to destroy aircraft on the ground. I thought maybe we'd see some cluster munitions to try and knock out these fighters before they could even rise to fight against the Russian fighters. And then I thought very closely after air superiority was established, and I'll tell you, I assessed air superiority would be established by the Russians within 48 to 72 hours. We're not quite to the 72-hour point as I record this, but I would say the Russians are not close to establishing air superiority. So I think I was wrong on that, and I'll talk about why I think I was wrong on that. But my initial assessment was air superiority within 48 to 72 hours, which is really going to allow the forward movement of Russian fighters and helicopters in support of a huge mechanized invasion. I thought they wouldn't move the mechanized invasion force as quickly as maybe they have. Now they've become completely bogged down, possible foreshadowing, but I thought they would really focus on knocking down Ukrainian air defenses prior to the war, or prior to a huge ground invasion. But that's not actually what happened. So anyways, just to wrap up the military buildup and the assessment of what the first night of the war would look like, Russia building up an A2AD bubble around the border of Ukraine and over the capital of Kyiv, forward deployment of lots of ground attack platforms to take advantage of air superiority once it was built up to support a huge Russian mechanized invasion. So that is what I anticipated going into the night of February 23rd, and in section two, we'll talk about what that first night and now the following couple of days has looked like. Okay, we're now into the actual battle. So overnight, at least here in America, overnight on the 23rd of February into the 24th of February, here in America, late Wednesday night into Thursday morning. We were looking for indications or unambiguous warning that an attack was going to happen. A couple of things happened on the day of the 23rd that made us think that there was a high potential that the conflict was going to happen. And then even before Putin spoke, it looked like that it was inevitable that the conflict was going to happen. The first thing that Russia did was it announced NOTAMs, or Notice to Airmen, that covered an Ukrainian airfield that was just outside of Donbas in the eastern part of Ukraine, and then a huge amount of airspace was covered by a NOTAM, basically that aircraft could not fly over almost the entirety of the Ukraine-Russia border. So what's the purpose of that? It is to make sure that nobody else flies in that region. Usually you do things like that for a military exercise or a live fire exercise or something like that. So a NOTAM that closes airspace in and of itself does not indicate war is inevitable. However, that was certainly an indication that tonight could be a night of, could be a night of operation. So that NOTAM, or the multiple NOTAMs that Russia put out, was of interest. I have not looked at U.S. intelligence. I wasn't in an operation center that night, but clearly the U.S. is tracking what's going on. And through users on social media that track aircraft, it was pretty clear that U.S. and NATO aircraft were leaving the airspace. It left that evening just one unmanned platform, an RQ-4 Global Hawk, was still flying over Ukraine. And then right about the 3 a.m. local time, that thing started to turn around. And all of this was being tracked live on Twitter. And as that thing is, and I'm sure other social media platforms, but at least that I was tracking on Twitter. And when that thing turned around, that was an indication to me that if we're getting everybody out, we probably have a pretty good indication that this thing's about to kick off. And then the other thing that I saw also on Twitter, again, completely unclassified, is that Russian bombers, or also known in the biz, if you will, as long-range aviation, or LRA, was active on unencrypted frequencies, and it's being tracked on social media and being put out there. That also, in and of itself, doesn't indicate that Russia is about to bomb something. They do long-range aviation missions across Russia into the U.S. Air Defense Identification Zone, or ADIZ, into European ADIZ. So that in and of itself didn't mean that a bombing mission was going to occur, but you're getting a lot of smoke on the night of the 23rd, the NOTAMs, the U.S. aircraft leaving Russian long-range aviation. And not surprisingly, right about 4 a.m. After that completely unhinged Putin speech, where he declared war and everything but that phrase itself, the strike actually began. I was anticipating a night one Desert Storm model. I've been criticized on my analysis as mere imaging, and I think that's probably a pretty valid criticism of the way I was looking at the conflict. However, as we're looking at it, maybe Russia should done a little bit more mirror imaging. They've clearly evaluated the way the U.S. has gone to war, but they did not execute an air campaign the way the U.S. and its allies typically have, and I think it's been to their detriment. And I'll try to lay out some of the things that I think they've done poorly over the first 72 hours. So what I anticipated was air and missile strikes on command, control, as well as communications, airfields, etc., with the purpose of, if not a decapitation — I'm not saying they were going after Ukrainian President Zelensky — but to try and cut him and military leadership off from their tactical units on the ground. So that was a big effort. We saw some of that. This is according to the Department of Defense, which has been doing a pretty good job of releasing information every morning in a press release or a press conference. The morning after, DOD said up to 160 cruise and ballistic missiles were launched, and that's pretty good. The Russians have invested in precision-guided munitions, but not to the level of U.S. and its allies, where almost every munition that we drop is a precision-guided munition. That's not the case with Russia. They don't have an unlimited storage of these precision-guided munitions, so that's a big effort by them. And these missiles were airborne, ground-based, and sea-launched missiles. I continue to look after the second day. It was 200 missiles, and then this morning DoD said 250 missiles. No evidence of any hypersonic missiles have been used, just primarily cruise missiles and a few ballistic missiles. Did not have the effect that I anticipated. The shock and awe was kind of not there, at least to the extent that I expected. And I think that's why you're still seeing Ukrainian air and air defenses still in the fight pretty clearly. So as I look at it, there's a few things that were missing from this shock and awe. The first was that the cyber attack was less than I expected. I anticipated and I predicted in a couple of different forums that I thought that Russian cyber actors would turn off the power, the heat, the comms in Kyiv, as well as maybe other critical parts of Ukraine. That didn't happen. Now, there were some websites that were down, but there were no at least effective attacks on cyber attacks on critical infrastructure. Is that Russia didn't want to, or that Ukrainian defenses were very good? It is unclassified that U.S. Cyber Command and the Ukrainians have been working together. I don't know what level. Maybe the U.S. and its allies and partners were helping with cybersecurity. I don't know. But I really anticipated that a new part of kind of a shock and awe campaign for the 21st century would be the integration of cyber effects to as a kind of force multiplier to help send shooters to help isolate them and send them autonomous. If they can't communicate via cyber means, via a voice, then they have to find targets themselves. It becomes a lot more difficult, but that didn't appear to happen. That was the second thing. So the first was that cyber attacks were less than I expected. The second is comms didn't go out. Night one in Desert Storm, the best battle damage assessment that the U.S. got in the Air Operations Center was watching CNN and waiting for the feed to go out, because they knew exactly when the F-117 was going to drop on the communications tower in central Baghdad. And when they did that, that was pretty clear. Or when the CNN feed went down, that was pretty clear to the folks in Riyadh that the F-117 had been successful. There was no similar strike, at least successful strike, in Kyiv. On the first night, comms didn't go out. People were still using their cell phones. People were still using satellite communications. And overall, there just wasn't a whole lot of effect on the ability for communications across the country. And so that leaves the SAMs and the fighters up. And why, you know, besides the cyber attack and the lack of attack on comms, I think there were probably too many targets for the numbers of precision-guided munitions they had. With the, if they knew they had 160 missiles to fire, give or take, maybe they shouldn't have attacked across the country. They were hitting even targets in the far west of Ukraine. Now, that does have an effect on the Ukrainians. However, you're not massing fires in order to reach specific effects. Perhaps had they focused a little bit more on the capital, maybe they would have been in airfields and surface air missile sites around the capital, perhaps they would have had a little bit more effect. So I just think they were targeting too much. The other thing they didn't have is stealth platforms. Now, they do have an operational stealth fighter, but they don't have anything like the F-117, the B-2. They're still in development on their stealth bomber, the PAC-DA. But what would be very helpful in this situation is to send not just air and missiles, but if they were to have stealth platforms like the F-117 or the B-2, is to send those over airfields and to drop cluster munitions or other munitions that can crater runways. And it doesn't even need to be stealth platforms. I mean, the Brits had a very effective weapon that did that in Desert Storm, but I didn't see a whole lot of cratering runways. There were definitely hits on airfields, but also didn't see any kind of cluster munition attacks on aircraft out at airfields. So they didn't really knock out airfields. Now, I definitely saw some video and pictures of airfields that had been hit. Some it appeared to be POL, petroleum oil and lubrication tanks were maybe hit. So they were hitting infrastructure, but they were not knocking airfields out. They weren't cratering runways to make airfields unusable. They weren't destroying enough aircraft on the ground. And that meant that the Air Force survived, and the Ukrainian Air Force has been able to put up sorties every day. They announced this morning, I'm recording this on the 26th, that on the 25th of February, they had 34 fighter sorties. I will use Ukrainian Ministry of Defense a lot here. I understand it could be propaganda. I am not saying for sure this is completely accurate. I do think that there is some accuracy here, and we've been seeing handheld video and photos that show certainly some Ukrainian aircraft are still getting off the ground. I think a big part of that was failure on night one of the Russians to knock them out. So I've mentioned multiple issues that I see: the ineffectiveness of cyber attacks, the lack of hitting communications, the lack of going after airfields, too many targets. There was also not the kind of time synchronization to create the shock and awe and paralysis that the US lives on, the US and its allies have done since the first night of Desert Storm. There just didn't seem to be that. There was a slow trickle of attacks throughout that night, and I stayed up all night watching whatever I could. But I didn't see that there was an overwhelming strike going on that would lead to paralysis. And then I think the last is overconfidence. And I have no hard evidence to indicate this, but this is just kind of a hunch that I've got, that the Russians felt like they were going to be able to land the knockout punch and do enough damage that their mechanized invasion would roll over the Ukrainians. And that clearly has not happened. Taken all together, I think what night one, I have a tough time saying from an air perspective is anything more than an abject failure for the Russians. They caused some pain. I don't know how many, but I think they destroyed aircraft and surface-to-air missile sites and probably did some damage to command and control, but certainly not enough to prevent aircraft from flying and surface-to-air missiles from identifying targets and firing on them. So, and we still see that happening. We are about to go into the fourth night of the air campaign, and there are still Ukrainian SAMs and fighters that are up right now. Ukraine this morning, so through the 25th, so about the first 60 hours of conflict, had claimed 14 fighter jets destroyed and 8 helicopters. And they are also claiming that during the day, so late, after midnight on the 26th through about the afternoon of the 26th, that they had shot down three more fighters, a Su-30, two Su-25s, 11 more helicopters, and two IL-76 cargo airplanes. So I don't want to take these numbers at face value and say for sure, yeah, they've knocked down 17 fighters and 19 helicopters and two cargo aircraft. I do think there is definitely a lot of smoke there. I think they have shot down a lot of aircraft. Now, I want to talk about those two IL-76s in particular. If reporting is to be believed, and there's a lot of reporting there, but I still haven't seen pictures or videos of an IL-76 candied on the ground. But supposedly those were bringing paratroopers or other soldiers into the fight, and that when those were shot down, somewhere around 300 paratroopers were killed. If that is cr true, those are huge, huge losses for the Russian. I might have been saying Ukrainian, but huge losses for the Russians if they did lose those two IL-76s and two plane loads of paratroopers or other soldiers. In terms of who's actually doing the killing, at least according to the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense, some have been lost to fighters. I will at the end talk the ghost of Kyiv. Don't worry about it. And then some to the S-300. They have SA-10 variants of the earlier variants of the S-300. So bottom line, what are we seeing? I'm going to get into a couple specific events, but the Russian air campaign has failed in knocking out the Ukrainian air and air defenses. And as we get close to the 72-hour point, which was my assessment, I don't think the Russians have achieved that. Not only do I not think, the Russians have not achieved air superiority. As we speak, we are getting ready for the fourth night of the fight. And I just in the as I took a break to grab something to drink between part one and part two, I saw on Twitter that Russian long-range aviation or Russian bombers are back up. This feeds my assessment, and by the time you're listening to this, I'll either be proven right or wrong. But I believe tonight, the night of the 26th and the 27th, is going to be a massive air and missile strike from Russia that may even surpass in number night one. I think yesterday was an absolute slap in the face, and by yesterday I mean the 25th of February into the night of the 25th and 26th. But I think it was a slap in the face. It was a wake-up call that they do not have air superiority. They are suffering huge and unacceptable and unsustainable losses. I think they are going to shepherd the amount of PGMs they have left, and I think you're going to see at least as many missiles that were fired on night one are going to be fired tonight, and they are going to go after the targets that they didn't do a very good job of hitting. Command and control, communications, airfields, and finding those surface-to-air missiles. I think tonight is going to be absolutely critical in the fight for air superiority. If Russia is really successful tonight, I think then you're going to start to see the kind of snowballing effect, and they're going to start to get a little bit more of a permissive air environment. That's going to give them better ability to target, to hit more things, to have a little bit more freedom of movement, and then you start to get the snowball of air superiority. And once that happens, the ability to move forward with the ground forces, with attack helicopters and fighters, and I think the snowball starts to happen, and you start to get a real chance of them taking the capital. If that doesn't happen tonight, I think Russia's going to be in a world of hurt in the battle for air superiority, because they're going to be have lost much of their standoff precision munitions. They're going to have to go in with fighters. They're going to have heavy losses. I still think eventually they'll be able to establish air superiority, but certainly not on the timeline that I thought. And definitely not air supremacy. So totally no useful opposition by the Ukrainians. I don't see Russian air supremacy anytime soon. A couple of things that I wanted to highlight in terms of air and airborne operations. The first is the battle for Hostomel Airfield, sometimes known as Anatov Airport. That's where the Anatov company builds or has some of their aircraft, including home to the one-of-a-kind AN-225, the world's largest cargo aircraft. Reporting says it's maybe been damaged in the fight, maybe destroyed. The company says it still survives. But this battle, so this airfield is just a suburb of Kyiv. It's just to the northwest. Russia clearly targeted this airfield as an airfield they wanted to take. They wanted to do an air assault with paratroopers, with helicopter-borne forces. They were going to take the airfield, and they were going to bring aircraft in. There was a report, pretty reliable report, that there were 18 IL-76 cargo aircraft that I kind of already talked, not kind of, that I did talk about earlier, can carry between 125 and 140 fully loaded paratroopers. There were 18 of those that were inbound to the airfield on the day of the 24th while this major fighting was going on. There was reporting that the Russians had taken it, then the Ukrainians took it back. Over the course of the day, about four times, I thought it changed hands. I don't think it actually happened that much. I think there was just a lot of reporting. Nonetheless, the battle swung towards the Ukrainians, at least on the day of the 24th. Those IL-76s had to turn back. And what happened with those IL-76s? Well, they were likely loaded with paratroopers, or what I think is more likely, heavy equipment for a battalion tactical group or BTG plus. So they were going to be bringing in the tanks and the infantry fighting vehicles, etc., to support those troops that were being brought in via helicopter. And when that didn't happen, I think that force was going to be one of the spearhead forces to try and take the capital. When those IL-76s did not land, they were missing a bunch of armor and a big punching power of the force that was going to try to take the capital. So when the Ukrainians took that airfield back, I think that had a major impact on the battle for Kyiv. And when we look back, and can't wait to read more about this as things, slow down, and hopefully this war comes to a quick conclusion. But battles and wars sometimes turn on very small events. It's tough to say for sure, but I think the battle for Hostomel may be one of those. Were the Russians able to take it? Were they able to get that armor in? Maybe they make a big push to Kyiv and either get President Zelensky or flush him out of the capital, and he goes to Lviv or somewhere else, and it meets their geopolitical objectives of deposing the president. That's all speculation on my part. In the future, I'm sure we'll learn more, but none of that happens through smart reinforcements and really brave fighting. The Ukrainian fighters kept the airfield. The Russians weren't able to get in. And there you go. Hostomel is not taken. There's reporting today on the 25th and 26th, or excuse me, on the 26th of February, that the Russians have taken the airfield. They claim it. They said that they got it, and they used it with over, or they took over 200 helicopters landed over the course of 24 hours to help them take the airfield, and they killed more than 200 Ukrainian special operations forces. I've also seen reporting that the airfield is absolutely demolished, and even if the Russians have it, they can't use it. Nonetheless, I think the impact of the battle already happened, which was slowing the overall Russian advance. The next thing I want to talk about is not one single battle. It's a mission. That's the suppression of enemy air defenses in the Air Force. We call that SEAD. My naval brethren like to call it SEAD. I'm not going to say they're wrong, but of course they are. So on the SEAD mission, and this is something that the U.S. has been doing for a very long time, and it's something that we have really has become a culture within the community. And I need to do a podcast on the wild weasel culture, those aircraft that identify, find, and destroy surface-to-air missiles. It's an unbelievable mission and incredibly important, and something that we did very, very well in 1991 and every successive air campaign after that. Russia's really got a wake-up call in the 2008 conflict in Georgia. It was a five-day conflict. They didn't send a ton of forces. By all indications, the Russian military, really writ large, but the Air Force in particular, performed poorly. There's still a lot of debate on how many aircraft were lost. You'll see anywhere between 6 and 11, which doesn't sound like a ton, but it was only a five-day, small, limited conflict. But even if you take the low end, that 6 aircraft were lost, there's also indications that maybe as many as 4 of them were to friendly fire. Nonetheless, that was higher than the rate of aircraft they expected to lose. And a lot of those were lost to surface-to-air missiles. And then friendly fire in and of itself indicates some significant issues in terms of communication, combat identification, etc. The Russian Air Force knew they didn't do very well, and the Russian military as a whole announced military reforms after that in order to improve their combat capabilities. Now, the 2014 annexation of Crimea was kind of a weird one. It was a very hybrid warfare focus. You may have heard the Little Green Men. They're Russian forces that didn't have any insignias on their uniforms, and they use disinformation saying it's not us, there's nothing going on, the Crimeans are Russian by historical experience, blah, blah, blah. And so they annexed it by force. And then, of course, we got the battle in the Donbas since 2014, where Russia has supported separatists, and that's a whole nother debate. But the bottom line is, the battles that have been going on in Ukraine since 2014 have not been large scale military experiences. So it's tough to try and take what Russia did in those and kind of extrapolate their military effectiveness. But we can look at the Russia's combat experience in Syria since 2015 on. They've sent very advanced equipment. In fact, I can't take credit for this, but a buddy of mine calls it the Syrian Test and Training Range, as a play on the Nevada Test and Training Range. Russia used Syria to test everything. They brought out surface-to-air missiles, including the S-400. They brought advanced fighters, including their fifth-gen fighter, trying to get combat experience for their crews, for their ground crew, etc. And we saw better employment. I still wouldn't say great combat employment, but certainly better. And I anticipated, though I didn't believe they would operate to the level of the U.S. and its coalition partners in the high-intensity part of conflicts that we've fought since really 1991, I did think they were going to be a lot better than 2008. And I thought they were really going to focus on the suppression and destruction of enemy air defenses. but I think they have been very, very unsuccessful so far. And I think that's why they've been having a lot of combat losses. So why are the reasons, as I look at it, that I think they've been ineffective in Seed? The first is, at least what I've been able to see, a lot less electronic warfare than I expected. We've always thought that the Russians invest very heavily in electronic warfare. And during the buildup of military forces, we did see a lot of electronic warfare vehicles, vehicles that could jam the GPS constellation, that could jam satellite communications, that could jam airborne radars, all kinds of stuff. It looked like they were going to jam across the electromagnetic spectrum and make it incredibly difficult for the Ukrainians and anybody that may be supporting them to communicate, to find and identify targets. And I haven't seen any evidence of that, at least to the level that I anticipated. I figured that electronic warfare would be a big player in trying to jam both radars and also the ability to communicate. And that hasn't seemed to happen. We do know that in terms of the suppression and destruction of enemy air defenses, that they have tried. So one way that we do suppression of enemy air defenses is not just with jamming. That's a big part of it. And we'll do jamming from multiple different platforms, but we also fire anti-radiation missiles or arms. The primary has always been the AGM-88 high-speed anti-radiation missile or HARM. So we'll fire hundreds of HARMs in the first night of conflict on radars. And the way, I probably should take a step back, for those of you who don't know how an anti-radiation missile works, very much like its name indicates, if there's a radar that is up and radiating and sending out signals, the missile inside has a passive receiver that is listening for that radar, and it hones in on it and destroys a radar that is up and operating. So that's a major way that we can destroy those radars. Now, if those radars are believing that they are under attack, they can turn off and the missile will go dumb and very, very likely miss. However, that's still suppression of enemy air defenses. If they turn off their radar, they're no danger anymore, right? So firing these HARMs, and we do have other weapons as well. We're developing a higher speed missile, and the AARGM and other countries have things like the Harpy, which is our anti-radiation UAV, et cetera, et cetera. It's not just the HARM, but I'll use that for the sake of ease here. But we'll fire a bunch of those. Russia did fire... We have evidence of at least one of their anti-radiation missiles, which we always used to call the Harmsky, a KH-31, a variant of the AS-17 Krypton missile that is an arm. I saw a very good image that seemed to show one of those broken up on the ground near a radar site. So I think they fired, and there's one, I would anticipate there were plenty more that were fired against these missiles. I can't tell you the effectiveness of them. I do know that they don't have nearly as many of those, as at least it's postulated, as we have of the HARMs. And I think the limited number means that they were not firing nearly as many as we would have in the same situation, as many HARMs as the U.S. and its coalition partners would have fired. The other thing that I'm not... It's tough for me to know because I wasn't there planning the Russian air campaign, is their plan for mobile SAMs. So part of the reason why the U.S. and its coalition partners were so effective in 1991 is it was before the era of mobile missiles, mobile radars, and mobile command and control. Virtually everything that the Iraqis had was set at a fixed location. And when people look at how the U.S. and its partners employed in 1991, one of the major takeaways is if something isn't moving, it will die. The Americans and their partners can find, identify, and kill virtually any target that doesn't move. What's shocking to me is that the Russians didn't seem to plan for this. They, of all people, have worked on making all of their systems in the air defense chain mobile. They have very advanced radars that are mobile. They've actually moved those forward, radars that have counter-low observable capabilities. It would be very dangerous to U.S. stealth platforms if we had decided to get into the conflict. So we know they've moved those radars forward. All of the surface-to-air missile systems that I talked about are all mobile, can be picked up and moved in a matter of minutes. They have mobile command and control vehicles. Every component of Russian air defense can be mobile. Why didn't they expect that with the Ukrainians who use their same equipment? Now it's older, but they should have anticipated that these things were going to be moving around. And I could tell you that finding any mobile target is very difficult, but these mobile SAMs are very difficult. They have to be up and radiating for you to be able to find them most of the time, unless they're not moving. I would anticipate the Ukrainians have had a lot of warning that this attack was going to happen and probably been moving things around. And to me, it looks like Russia did a poor job of finding those mobile systems. And what's my evidence of that? The fact that there's still S-300s, Ukrainian S-300s are up alive, radiating, and killing, at least if you believe what the Ukrainians are saying. So when I look at it, I've seen some major, major tactical errors by the Russian air forces that are resulting in strategic level effects. So they're not only affecting the operational battlefield, they're having strategic level effects in that the whole offensive is slowing down. I think that is probably helping to feed the anti-war feeling in Russia. I mean, I'm making a little bit of a postulation here, but nonetheless, tactical mistakes, tactical execution errors, and tactical effectiveness on the behalf of the Ukrainian air and air defense forces are having at least operational and potentially strategic level effects. So, what have I taken from the first 72 hours? Russia has not done it well. I anticipate that by the time you listen to this, I'm going to look either smart or very dumb based off of the attacks that are going to happen tonight. Because I think tonight's going to be a major, the night of the 26th and the 27th of February, I think it's going to be a major push for Russia to fix the ills or the mistakes they've made, in particular in air defense. So that is it for right now, through not quite 72 hours of the air war. And next up is I'm going to cover some of the questions that you all had on Twitter. All right, let's get into part three, which is Q&A. This is the first time I've really done this on any of the podcasts. I keep saying that I will, but got a lot of really good questions asked, so I'm going to try to get to all of those, as many of them as I can. So I'm going to start with one of my very good Air Force friends at KellyKGB11, who asked a question. Another Air Force buddy at Jason Baker JB had a very similar question. Really, it's getting after significant tactics, engagement, employment, things that we've seen in the first couple of days of the conflict. And really, I think we're talking Russian here. So, just kind of four things, and I just spent a bunch of time talking about it, so I'm not going to spend too much time. I think four major things that I see. The ineffectiveness, or maybe a better way to say it, is lack of effectiveness of the standoff weapon strikes, and in particular, their force packaging of those strikes. I would think they would be doing jamming. I think they'd be doing cyber attacks. I think they would be going after critical infrastructure, both via kinetics and non-kinetic weapons, to really sow instability, discord, chaos, etc., in Kyiv and some of the other major cities of Ukraine. And I just haven't seen that. The shock and awe has really lacked both shock and awe for me. The second would be really poor suppression of enemy air defenses. And I really expected that Russia would make this a major, major focus area after their really poor showing in the 2008 Georgia campaign. And I just haven't seen it. I've been very surprised at how poor that has been. Pleasantly surprised from the Ukrainian side because they are still able to get SAMs up radiating and shooting, and they're still able to get aircraft off the ground. The third major thing would be air-to-air combat is still ongoing. The Ukrainian Air Force has not been knocked out of the fight. And that and possible foreshadowing, we'll talk about it a little bit more when we get into the ghost of Kyiv in section four or part four. And then my fourth major takeaway would be air superiority is still important. And there's another question on this a little bit later, but you really need air superiority as a critical first step in a campaign. And the Russians established naval superiority, damn near naval supremacy already, and that helps. But you can see that without air superiority, you're still not going to win a war. And I'm not one of those. Everybody just stop before you turn this off. I'm not an air power theorist that says air alone wins wars. But air superiority makes everything else easier, and it allows those war-winning forces to do the business and win the wars. Air superiority is necessary in fights today and in the future, and I don't know when that will change. This is not something I wrote in my notes. I guess number five would be, and it kind of goes with the electronic warfare. I haven't mentioned space at all. I anticipated there would be tons of electronic warfare against space. I didn't know that we'd necessarily get a kinetic attack against a space asset. I thought maybe we'd get non-kinetic attacks, and that's sort of baked into when I talk about the fact that they haven't gone after satellite communications, etc. They also, the Russians have not gone after precision navigation and timing. I thought maybe we would see jamming of GPS, and we haven't. So there's been a lot less fighting or space being contested than I thought there would. At D Bowl Jr. Goes by the awesome handle Gomer, starter of sourdough. I would bet anything that was a COVID lockdown kind of thing and started getting into sourdough. We bake bread here at the Wetzel House at the beginning of COVID as well. D Bowl Jr. asks about threat ID with countries flying similar platforms. And I already talked about the deconfliction measures like the big Z or diagonal lines on some of their armor vehicles because they have a lot of very similar equipment. Ukraine, obviously, used to be part of the Soviet Union. A lot of their military equipment is still Soviet era equipment that is either still being used by the Russians or very similar. This is incredibly difficult. And Gomer, I don't have a great answer for you other than to say that it is incredibly difficult. I think what it comes down to is type ID is probably not going to be good enough because if you see flanker, well, the Ukrainians have flankers. The Russians have multiple variations of flanker. So really it comes down to combat ID via electronic means and whether that would be interrogation of friend or foe, automated interrogation, whether it is flying specific areas, deconfliction, that becomes very difficult in air combat because if you say, hey, we're going to stay, just as an example, where the Ukrainians were going to stay west of the Dnieper River, and then you follow a Russian aircraft to the east of it. Well, now your plan for deconfliction is gone, and maybe you're getting launched at by an S-300, a Ukrainian S-300. So really what it comes down to on threat identification is it has to be done via electronic means. I also think Russia, part of the reason, well, first off, they didn't have a whole lot of MiG-29s in theater, but I don't think they're using MiG-29s because they want to not even worry about that. So even though they could have brought some of their few operational MiG-29s into theater, I think what would be the point? It would be more harm than good. Partly some of the reason why we didn't have our allies fly Mirage F1s in Desert Storm. We didn't have the French fly Mirage F1s because, and there was also some other Gulf Coast countries that had them. Because Iraq did, and why even have to worry about two of the same platforms? So I think Russia did a little bit of that. Really, it comes down to I don't see a way to do this besides electronic identification. I do also think that the Russians have proven the adage that it's very difficult to do fighter and missile deconfliction. I haven't been seeing the S-400 doing a lot of killing, and granted, this is only what I'm seeing. And I think part of that is because they've had their fighters and aircraft up, so they've not been using their surface-to-air missiles to reach into Ukraine. I think they are in a defensive posture, and that way they don't have to worry about shooting down their own aircraft. So I don't think that's a great answer, Gomer, other than saying it's really difficult. Maybe one of my most engaged listeners who responds back to quite a few questions when I put them out here, and I appreciate that, is at Jet Consultant One. How do you shoot down an MI-24 Hind or an MA-8 and 17 Hip without air cover? Courage. That's a big risk. And so shooting down aircraft with either RPGs or manned portable air defense systems, those shoulder fire missiles, I mean, it goes back even beyond the days of Black Hawk down to the days of Charlie Wilson's War. But you're very, very susceptible when you leave a building to actually go out and fire, or when you leave cover to go fire at a helicopter. So that is another one that I don't have a great answer for. Things that I think are really important are tactics that were used against the US in Iraq and Afghanistan, which would be overlapping fields of fire and different fire. So somebody hops out of a building, fires an AK-47, something like that, and you get an aircraft reacting to that, maybe trying to shoot at whoever just shot at them, and then you have another shooter that is going for the tail rotor or something like that with the RPG or the manned portable air defense system. So I think those overlapping fields of fire is really important. I will tell you, it's not a job I want. I like being in the air operations center where I feel relatively safe and don't have a shoulder-fired missile that I'm running out from undercover. So I don't have a good answer for you on how you shoot one of those down without undercover, other than being very, very brave, which I think the Ukrainians have shown that they most certainly are. The next question is from at Joe D. LOLOLOL, whose handle is Russian Warship Go F Yourself, which is one of the highlights so far of this conflict. And he asked about the MiG-29 Su-35 dogfight video. And then at Total Panda said it basically, hey, was that the ghost of Kyiv? So first off, most of the dogfight videos have been completely debunked as Ace Combat or other video games. And part of that is a lot of dogfights are not happening at ground level where you can use your cell phones. Most of it is happening at altitude, even if there is a lot of altitude change in those in air combat. I've seen some video that is showing a lot of contrails that are turning, and I think that's more likely the air combat that we're seeing. But the video that Joe talked about is the one that I think is legitimate. And what you see is a MiG-29 and a Su-35 that are moving in relationship to each other. I will tell you the video looked legit. It hasn't been debunked as far as I've been able to see. And I talked it over with some friends, and what it looked like to us was the MiG-29 was looking to convert an attack on the Su-35, but did not appear to get the intercept geometry correct and looked to overshoot that attack, not being able to either fire or fire effectively at the Su-35. And then as he overshoots, you see the Su-35 make a left-hand turn to stern convert, or to convert onto the stern of that MiG-29. And that's where the clip ends. I do think that's the one legitimate clip that we've seen. I can tell you, I would not want to be that MiG-29 pilot at the end of that video. It looks like the Su-35 is in a position in the control zone or pretty close to it where that pilot will be able to employ missiles or within very short order the gun. And I would say the MiG-29 is in a bad spot. Total Panda is asking, was that the ghost? Stand by. Could be. That could be the video of the ghost. At Logan T907 said, have Russian tactics in respect to OSINT reporting or radio chatter, etc., have they changed? And I would say, no, I can't believe it. They've done a really bad job of operational security or OPSEC. They just, I can't understand it. As an example, I'm recording, I'm looking at the clock, it is 4:22 p.m. Eastern Time. A couple hours ago, I saw on Twitter that Russian long-range aviation is up and talking in the clear. I can't understand why they do it. I can't tell you why, I have no idea, but I think they are making a pretty big mistake. Very closely related to that, at H1 Nerd had a great question that basically boils down to, is OSINT, open source intelligence, good or bad? Or tell us what good and bad came out of it. Man, open source intelligence, sometimes called publicly available information, came of age in this conflict. So what am I able to learn from open source? First off, some people have been talking about how the fact that in the future, most of our intelligence is going to come from unclassified sources. It's going to be open source intelligence or OSINT. I completely agree. I think the days of our really expensive, really classified intelligence sources of giving us the primary amount of intelligence, I think those days are kind of over. I think where we are right now is that most of our intelligence going forward is going to be based on open source means. And so what have we been able to see? So first off, I would say no notice invasion is pretty much impossible, outside of maybe Korea, because they have so many forces, the North Koreans on the border. But anybody that's going to build up a big force, you're going to have to do something with it. Like, or you have to move it into theater, and people are going to pick it up via via video or phone or whatever. I also saw on the first night, traffic apps were being used to show where forces were going. There was traffic in Belgrade, I believe, on the way south to Kharkiv. Wow, what a way, like an hour before the war kicked off, there's this, at 3-4 in the morning here in Russia, there is a traffic jam. Why? Well, that looked like it may have been the invasion beginning. So what would I take away from that? The first is, as much as I hate to say this, because at some point I will deploy again, but do not bring iPhones, don't bring watches, don't bring anything, because all that stuff leaves a digital trail or digital exhaust, and our data is ubiquitous. And if and we haven't even seen all of the ways that data is going to be used, but if you have a device that is connected in any way to the internet, it's going to be collectible. People are going to use it in new and unique ways, and I think we're just seeing part of that. I think in my business, that's going to be incredibly important. It's going to be a huge amount of data in the future, and that's why we talk a lot about artificial intelligence and machine learning. We can't have individuals wade through all of that data. You need the machines to wade through all that data, to look for patterns, to develop usable, timely, and accurate information, and then have the intelligence analyst try to make something of that data-driven conclusion and to do some analysis and some predictive analysis off of that. And the last piece of this is OSINT good or bad is we better be really focused on denial and deception, military deception in particular. It's going to continue to be really important. And I know many of my listeners are not big John Boyd fans. I continue to threaten that I'll do a both sides of John Boyd arc, where we'll talk about you know, the goods and the bads. But and I know some people hate his OODA loop, but for those of you not familiar, the observe, orient, decide, and act loop is used a lot in the military as the decision cycle, it's called. The ability to orient correctly and to deny that to the adversary is going to be incredibly important. If we can use open source intelligence to observe and orient to what the adversary is doing and deny them the ability to do the same through things like military deception, we're going to be in a much better place. That's what some people have called information dominance. I think that's going to be incredibly important. So H1 Nerd, you hit on a topic that Air-Minded Nerd loves to talk about. So sorry for taking a little bit too long on that one. Last question was from at Andrea Scioto, I believe. Does this war give you a new take on airspace control? So I may be answering this incorrectly. Airspace control can mean, you know, just how we actually control aircraft that are flying. I think what you were really trying to get after is air superiority, and I'm going to answer it as, is this a new take on air superiority? And if I answered it incorrectly, I'm sorry. I think that we have learned that air superiority still is incredibly important, and I answered that in KGB's question, is that it doesn't win. Air superiority doesn't win wars, but it does enable the forces that win wars. If Russia had air superiority established over the last couple of days, they probably would have been able to get in a lot more troops and their associated armor and weapons. And they may have been able to already either take the capital or be able to flush President Zelensky out of the capital, giving a huge win to Putin, who then wouldn't have to worry about instability in his country. So that's where I'm talking about tactical execution errors can have strategic level effects. I think had Russia been able to develop air superiority, I think this whole battle looks a lot different. I think the ground war looks way different and potentially much, much worse for Ukraine. And we may be much closer to the collapse of Ukraine than we are right now. And as I speak here at 4:30 on the 26th of February, collapse of Ukraine doesn't look imminent. It doesn't look like it's going to happen at all. And Vladimir Putin's position in Russia Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying he's going to be deposed or there's going to be a coup anytime soon, but it certainly looks a lot weaker, his position, than it did 4 or 5 days ago. I don't think you can say that all comes down to Hostomel Airfield, but boy, that one battle could maybe change the fight for air superiority, could change the fight for the capital, could change this war. So anyways, that is it for these questions, and with that said, we'll get on to the ghost of Kiev. All right, section 4, the ghost of Kiev. Now we know that every conflict needs its heroes, and this one already has a couple of different options for heroes. Of course, there were the brave defenders of Snake Island who told that Russian vessel to go F itself. Who could forget the elderly Ukrainian woman who went to that Russian soldier and wanted to put sunflower seeds into his pocket that said, when you're basically dead and fertilizing the ground, at least something good will come from it because of the sunflowers, obviously the national flower of Ukraine. And then, of course, there's the ghost of Kiev. And I can't imagine anybody that listens to this podcast hasn't heard or read about the ghost of Kiev. So the ghost is supposedly a Ukrainian MiG-29 pilot that has shot down 6 enemy aircraft, becoming an ace in a day. Of course, ace shooting down 5 enemy aircraft. And I don't think we've had an ace in a day since World War II when it happened a few times. If the reporting is to be believed, the Ghost shot down 2 Su-35s, so the most advanced platform in theater, a Su-27, a fellow MiG-29, remember both Russia and Ukraine fly them, and then 2 Su-25 ground attack platforms. I will tell you, I've been the biggest doubter of the ghost. I didn't believe that it happened. I thought it was a good story. For those of you who've heard about Colonel Toom, North Vietnamese pilot, it was really more not a real person. It was a conglomeration of people that supposedly shot down all these aircraft, and the real person was eventually shot down. But it was built up to be kind of a larger than life personality. And I think that's what happened. At least that's what I've been thinking about for the ghost. Now, some things about the MiG-29. It is no longer considered to be kind of the frontline fighter for Russia. I'm old enough that used to be the primary platform that we would brief. It is definitely a very capable point defense fighter. It's got very low fuel, so it typically only flies within maybe 30 minutes of its own airfield, and it doesn't carry a lot of munitions. It does have a very capable infrared-guided missile and a somewhat capable radar-guided missile. And then a large caliber gun, but a very small number of rounds. Now, the MiG-29, some people have said there's no chance it could happen because there's so low fuel. But to that point, I think the MiG-29 would take off and land and fly again and fly multiple sorties. So I do think it's possible. And actually, there was a MiG-29 defector who wrote a book called Fulcrum Pilot that I highly recommend, and basically said, you know, MiG-29 is a great platform if you want to defend your own airfield. And that's exactly what the Ghost was supposedly doing. Over the last 2 days, two different names have come out for who the ghost is. The first, and actually, it's starting to be pushed in some semi-official Ukrainian press, including a former president of Ukraine, saying there is a ghost, he's out there fighting. There have been two names that have been pushed on social media. The first was a picture of a female pilot named Tatiana Lisnenko. And really, I should have apologized at the beginning for my awful pronunciation of all Russian and Ukrainian names. But anyways, supposedly that was the ghost. And then the second that came, so that was yesterday that Tatiana's name was put out. And then today, Vladimir Abdonov was another name that was put out there. Unfortunately, I hate to break it to you, both those have been completely debunked. The pictures, first of Tatiana, is an old picture. There's a picture of her in a fulcrum and thumbs up or whatever. That's an old picture, has been found from previous social media posts in 2018 or 2019. And nobody's been able to confirm that that name has ever been in the Ukrainian Air Force. And in fact, it was the name of a, I believe it was a gymnast, but some Olympic athlete. Bottom line is that that is pretty well debunked. And then today, Vladimir Abdonov came out, and a lot of people, it's actually been getting a little bit of traction. A lot of people think that he is a ghost. First off, the picture shown for Vladimir has also been debunked. It is a very poor job of taking another individual's pictures and putting this guy's changing the face around a little bit. So the pictures have already been debunked, and also there's no proof that that individual has ever served in the Ukrainian military or the Ukrainian Air Force. So I think both of those names are definitely not the ghost. And I've been pretty clear in my somewhat small niche following in air-minded Twitter, if you will, that I have been a big doubter of the ghost. I could tell you that I've had multiple U.S. Air Force sources who've communicated with me and said that the individual did occur or did the event did happen. There is such an individual. That individual has worked with U.S. Air Force aircrew. It did happen as the reporting has happened, but unfortunately, that individual was killed on the 24th. I was given a name. That name checks out. A simple Google search indicates that individual is or was a Ukrainian Air Force fighter pilot. It is the most plausible of all the names that I've gotten. And I've been given some other supporting materials that makes me believe that that individual is in fact a ghost. I spent a while debating whether to give the name of the ghost, and in the end, I've decided not to for a couple reasons. First off, maybe the ghost is alive, and there would at least be the risk that you're putting that individual's life in danger. I think it's a slight risk. If the ghost gets shot down, it'll probably be over Ukraine, so it'll probably not fall into Russian hands, but it's certainly possible. And if some, knucklehead on Twitter has identified that individual as the ghost, I can't imagine that that would make life easier in captivity. Again, I think it's probably a small risk, but it's a risk nonetheless. And if the ghost was killed in action, as I believe the ghost was, then that information is going to come out, and that individual will be praised as the hero of Ukraine that they are. So I'd rather it just come out like that. So as much as I'd like to believe that the ghost is out there and prowling the skies over Kyiv, I don't think that's the case anymore. I do believe the ghost is real, even if exactly the story as it was laid out. The MiG-29 pilot shooting down six aircraft, even if it didn't happen exactly like that, I do believe that a Ukrainian Air Force pilot did become an ace in a day, fighting to protect their homeland and gave their life in defense of their country. So I don't know for sure, but that's what I choose to believe. So tonight, I'll tell you what I'm going to do is I'm going to toast the memory of the ghost and hope that we have more really brave Ukrainian Air Force pilot, army soldiers, etc., that continue to fight the good fight against a brutal invasion force and hopefully not occupier. But anyways, can't think of a better way to end than saying we should all give a toast to the ghost of Kyiv, and at least the idea is something that I think we can all get behind. So, with that said, so long from me, the air-minded gorilla, Tyson Wetzel. I'll probably do another one of these as the war goes a little bit further and we've learned a little bit more. In the meantime, feel free to follow me at air-mindedpod or my personal at gorilla Wetzel, one word. I'd be happy to interact with you. I've been doing a lot of not just talking about air, but overall Ukrainian military situation. I'd be happy to continue interacting. Of course, I got to put the standard disclaimer on. All the positions expressed are mine alone. They do not reflect the official position of the Department of Defense or the United States Air Force. And with that said, this is the Air-Minded Gorilla, Tyson Wetzel, signing off.